today about some work I've been doing with Professor Olpinny at UV, where we attempt to address this question of how well we're constraining the primordial power spectrum with cosmological data. So we know that around 13.7 billion years ago, inflation generated a spectrum of primordial density perturbations. So these were the seeds that will later grow into all the structure of the universe. Prior to that, at the time of last scattering, these tiny inhomogeneities were locked into the cosmic microwave background with temperature fluctuations. So by measuring these fluctuations in the CMB and by carrying out large-scale structure surveys, we can help hope to pin down the form of the primordial power spectrum. And so this is the status of the spectrum today. Typically, when we try to constrain it, you first need to assume some sort of anisotropy for the form of the power spectrum. And this is a common one. You assume that it's a power law or close to power law. And it is called the spectral index. This just measures the slope of the spectrum. And you can additionally include some scale dependence here called the running of the spectral index. When you consider both of these, the latest WMAP data, third year, and Sloan Digital Sky Survey give the following one sigma constraints on these parameters. So it seems like I've just answered the question posed in the title, which is, this is how well constrained the primordial power spectrum is. But we have to be very careful. This is how well constrained this particular form of the power spectrum is. And so we have to remember that we are ignorant.
Is that 1.21?
Yeah, so this is big because we're including Running.
So if you don't include the other one, you have
If you don't include Running, then the menu is less than one at about 2 sigma.
Okay. What do you mean by
K? So K is just some fiducial scale. This would just be some pivot scale, taken usually to be around 0.002 h inverse megaparsec. I guess where it was taken in this study. All right, so we're assuming a form of the power spectrum for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's simple. And the second, which I'll talk more about, is that it's what we expect from the simplest models of single field solar inflation. And lastly, most importantly, it's the best we can do with current data. So current data is marred by various sources of uncertainty. We have cosmic variance, which is a sampling variance, owing to the fact that we only have a single universe to observe. We have instrumental noise. We have foregrounds that contaminate the primordial signal. And just to see where these things come into play, this is a plot of the temperature spectrum from WMAP3. Cosmic variance is large on large angular scales, since we have fewer independent measurements that we can make with the CMB sky. And as we move to smaller scales, we begin to get hindered by instrumental noise. And so we see that we have potentially a lot of leeway here in fitting the shape of this spectrum. And so it's entirely possible that the spectrum is not even approximately a power law form. And this is a question we want to address today. And there's a couple reasons why it may not be a power law form, and I'm going to address two. One, we may just have some complicated dynamics driving inflation. And secondly, I want to talk a little bit about non-trivial emission conditions for the quantum fluctuations.
What do you mean non-trivial initial condition? I mean, the trivial initial condition is just the density matching.
Exactly. Yeah, well, you'll see.
So you see that by getting different answers for the exponent, if you fit WMAP or large scale structure?
For which exponent?
Well, I mean, if you say it's entirely possible it's not power law. So one indication of that would be if you fit different data sets on different scales, you would find different answers for your route, for your exponent.
Right. Well, in this study, we're just considering CMB and large scale structure data. So
together,
simultaneously. And so we don't want to assume anything on the outset as far as what the form of the spectrum looks like. So we don't want to write down a parameterization and then tweak the parameters. We want to try to remain, as you see, as general as possible in the study. So actually, I'm going to say that right now. About this, focusing on examining non-trivial inflationary dynamics, this is just kind of the outlook of where we're headed. We want to be able to test a wide variety of spectral shapes to see which ones yield satisfactory fits to the data. And we want to take a purely phenomenological approach. So we don't want to make any assumptions about the form. And we're going to develop a method to do exactly this, to generate parameterization-independent spectra. And lastly, we want to be able to connect these general spectra to some underlying inflaton model. So here's the outline. We're going to briefly introduce inflation. Most of you will probably be insulted by this, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. And then I want to talk mostly about this idea of generalizing potential. I'm going to talk about flow formalism, which is the heart of this method. And then I'm going to review the evolution of environmental perturbations during inflation. I'll put it all together in methodology, and then I'll conclude with some results. And then lastly, I'm going to talk a bit about modifying initial conditions inflation. All right, so let's briefly define what inflation is. So it's simply an accelerated expansion of the universe. We know that makes the universe extremely flat and homogeneous, and it's tropic on large scales. But remarkably, it also produces small-scale inhomogeneity, and it does this by amplifying quantum fluctuations in the fields in the universe during inflation. So these come in two types. We have a spectrum of scalar perturbations. These are just perturbations in the energy density of the universe. These are the ones that go on to form structure. And we also have tensor perturbations, which are manifest as gravity waves. So we describe the universe during inflation using the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric. And a scale factor, it governs the expansion rate of the space. And the second quality of introduced conformal time. This is just a clock that slows down the expansion of the universe. Einstein's equations for a flat part of the universe take the following form. This is called the Friedman equation. H is the Hubble parameter, and this determines the expansion rate of the universe. On the right-hand side, we have the energy density. Now, during inflation, we typically assume that the universe is filled by only a single scalar field. Well, you can assume more than one, but simplistically, we'll take a single scalar field that's homogeneous, in which case rho takes the following form. The first term is just kinetic energy, and this is just an arbitrary potential. So the scalar field itself obeys an equation of motion. It's a Planck-Gordon equation with an additional cosmological friction piece here. And lastly, we get another equation out of GR, and it's an acceleration equation for the scale factor. So this relates to the second time derivative of A with the stress energy. And a quick glance at this expression reveals that GR can give us accelerated expansion if we have a scalar field for which the potential energy is dominating over the kinetic energy. So we've all seen this. This is just the definition of inflation. So before we go on, I want to change our dynamic variable. So the Friedman equation treats A of t as the dynamic variable, and t where t is time. And instead, I want to model things by looking at h as a function of the field phi. So phi is a perfect time variable so long as we're just rolling in one direction, and that will be the assumption that we're making throughout. In which case, the equation's motion reduces to the following. So the first is a first order equation for h. Here primes are denoting derivatives with respect to the field phi. So this first equation is referred to as Arnold's Jacobi equation, and we'll see it again a little bit later on. So the condition for inflation, that a double prime be greater than zero, becomes the following. We introduce this parameter epsilon. This is well-known in literature, and it is often referred to as a Sloral parameter, but we're defining it here without any assumption of Sloral. So we're defining it here in terms of h and this first derivative. And the nice thing about this variable is so long as it's less than one, we know that the universe is inflating. So what's so special about inflation? Well, it's super literal expansion. And the way to see this is, consider what's happening with the horizon. So the horizon is just the region of the universe within which everything is in causal contact, and this thing is just expanding at the speed of light. So in units per c is equal to 1, the horizon size just goes as t. But if you focus on some physical light scale, which is growing with the expansion, during inflation, A looks like this. Well, for a slowly varying epsilon, which is the case of interest in Sloral inflation, and since epsilon is less than 1, we see that the physical length scale grows faster than the horizon. So this has a profound effect on quantum fluctuations. So if we just focus on a typical Fourier mode, let's say, a quantum field existing within the horizon, inflation will take this thing and blow it up to super horizon scales. And at which point, once it crosses outside the horizon, this part of the wave can no longer talk to this part of the wave. And this thing freezes out, becomes a classical density fermentation.
You say 1 over x is proportional to t, is that?
Yes.
And epsilon is slowly changing.
I epsilon is constant?
Yeah. So this is,
yeah.
Okay, so just to some qualifiers here. When the mode is well within the horizon, we have this ratio. The physical wave number to the Hubble radius is a lot larger than 1. And then as we go to larger scales, the physical wave number over h becomes much smaller than 1. We'll refer to these limits later on the talk. Okay, so the amplitudes of the spectra generated by this process look like the following. So this first one is the scalar spectrum. At k equals ah means that we're measuring the amplitude of the spectrum as that particular mode is crossing the horizon. And we also have the spectrum of tensor perturbations, as I mentioned. So you might ask the question if there's any scale dependence to the power spectrum. In other words, if you were to sit on the horizon and measure the amplitude as each node crosses out, would you see a time dependence on the amplitude? And we can answer that question by simply taking the logarithmic derivative of p with respect to k. And we get the following grouping of parameters. We're just going to call this number n. So here I've introduced a new variable, eta. This is h double prime over h.
And so this is also wrong, right? Because the first line would break down.
That's right. So this is an approximation. We're assuming that epsilon and eta are small and slowly varying. So this is the slow roll approximation. So what we're seeing is that during slow roll, we have a power law spectrum where n is given by this collection of slow roll parameters. Where here k is a co-moving wave number. So this is the physical wave number modeled out by the expansion rate. So this is a time-dependent variable that we attribute to each varying mode. So during slow roll, epsilon and eta, which I've written as functions of h, reduce the following expressions in terms of p. So the lesson is that when slow roll is valid, if I can go out and measure the scalar and tensor power structure, the amplitudes, and if I can also measure the spectral index, then I can reconstruct the first derivatives of p, as well as its overall amplitude on some scale. Now it turns out that a large number of models, surprisingly, are well approximated using slow roll. So just to look at a couple, chaotic inflation are driven by these polynomial type potentials. And chaotic inflation leads to spectra that are have spectral indices that are less than one and give a amplitude, a ratio of tensor to scalar power that is typically large, larger than 0.01. Another topic in our class of models are those that would be involved in some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And near the local maximum of such potential, you can describe it like this. And these also lead to red spectra and typically have suppressed tensors relative to chaotic models. And there's a third class that we're really not going to talk very much about, but it's included for completeness. These are hybrid models. This is the simplest tree-level expression you might see. So this field by itself leads to internal inflation, and typically you need some sort of a secondary field to end inflation. But these are distinct in that they yield blue spectra and unmeasurably small tensors. So these classes of models are strongly ruled out by current data. We're not going to talk about them further. So what we want to do is we want to be able to move beyond slow roll because we're interested in examining more generalized power spectra. So we know that slow roll approximation leads to close to power law spectra. We need to completely move away from this. But we also don't want to work within the confines of any one particular class of models. So we want to somehow develop a parameterization-independent approach to exploring the model space. So this is where we're headed. And so the next step is to start with the flip models. Any questions so far? This is all reviewed, I think. Okay, so flow formalism is a numerical method for stochastically generating an inflation model, or many inflation models. And the way you begin is by defining the following hierarchy of flow parameters. So we've already seen these first two. There's no reason to stop there. You can just define this infinite tower of higher order parameters. So L lambda is proportional to the L plus first derivative of H. Now, when using the flow approach, it's convenient to switch our time variables. So instead of using phi as our time variable, we're going to use this number called n. So n is the number of defaults before the end of inflation. N is equal to 0, defines the end of inflation. And so larger positive values of n denote earlier times.
You also put the first derivative of h, which is generalized parameter.
Yeah. Right, the first derivative is some power.
Some power, yeah. So yeah, the first derivative of some power times the n plus 1.
Right,
that's right. Is there a reason for this? This convention.
This is convention. There's other parameters in use.
Because it is not the first derivative, it's not in the second and slow parameter, right?
No, it's not.
Okay.
So after you've introduced this new time variable, you can write down the following set of differential equations. So this system of equations relates all the flow parameters. So I've introduced a new combination of flow parameters here, so it's not important, but just to point it out. So if you want to solve this thing in real life, you clearly need to truncate it at some finite order. And so if you truncate at some order m, the structure of the flow equations ensure that all the higher order parameters vanish for all time. And so what that means is that a solution to this truncated system is exact. what exactly is the solution? What's the physical significance? Well, we end up with some function h of m, which is some solution to the vacuum space time of an FRW universe. How do you implement this? Well, you draw initial conditions randomly for the flow parameters, and then you evolve the flow equations forward in time until either inflation ends, epsilon goes through 1, or the solution asymptotes to 0. So this latter situation occurs in cases of hyperinflation. So we're not going to talk about these further. We're just interested in these types of models. Once epsilon passes through 1, you stop. You turn around and you evolve the system backwards in time from n equals 0 out to some n drawn randomly from this range. So we know that we need between 46 and 60 e-folds of inflation in order to cure the problems of classical cosmology, namely the horizon flatness problem. So I mean, you can tweak this range. It's not overly important. Once you find a model that satisfies this time duration, you can go ahead and reconstruct the inflaton potential using this expression. So recall we have h and epsilon as functions of n from solving the flow equations, and we can now find v as a function. This is just the Hamilton-Jacobi equation that I wrote down for earlier.
Can I ask you something? Mm-hmm. Isn't it possible to have like a period where epsilon is larger than 1 and then it's becomes smaller than 1 again?
Epsilon can go through 1 parallel. But
you assume that when it crosses 1, then the inflation finishes that.
In full generality, you don't need to assume that. You can, if you're expecting that to happen, you can implement things to keep those models that only violate epsilon greater than 1 for a short period of time. So, If the time derivative of epsilon changes, for instance, if it's going to come back down through 1, you can keep that model behind those.
And it can turn as well.
That's right, it can. And actually, the models we're looking at, that can happen. So we want to be careful to retain those models and not throw them out. But so we're talking about epsilon going through 1 after a large portion of the trajectory has already occurred. OK, then you repeat this process over and over and over again. And you generate a vast collection of inflaton potentials. So a typical output from the method looks like this. So this is the y-axis is epsilon, and this is sigma. This is 2 eta minus 4 epsilon. And all these dots represent the values of these parameters on observable scales. So each of these dots is an inflation model. There's a potential that's associated with each of these dots. So the shape is quite remarkable, and Professor Kinney and others have talked extensively about it. What I want to focus on is the fact that really only a small number of these are probably well-classified as Sloral models. In order for Sloral to be a valid approximation, we need epsilon and sigma to be small. So really only this gray box here can we safely assume that we probably have parallel spectra, and those spectra can be determined from potential using these expressions. What about all these guys? Tons of these models are probably not even close to parallel, and we'd like to be able to strengthen the flow approach by obtaining the power factor for these things, not having to rely on these approximations. So what we're talking about next is how you actually go about doing that. We want to actually solve the evolution equations for the quantum fluctuations that generate the perturbation spectrum. And so as I mentioned, the fields start off as fluctuations during inflation, and we're really interested in fluctuations in two different fields. Fluctuations in the field driving inflation, known as the inflaton, these are the ones that actually form large scale structure, and then we also have fluctuations in the gravitational field, and these are gravity waves. Both of them contribute to the temperature isotropy in the CMB, but only the inflaton fluctuations form large scale structure, as I mentioned. So how do we model these? Well, we simply perturb phi without some background value. We note that delta phi couples to the background curvature, so it couples to the metric perturbation. Metric perturbation can be written the following way. It's a function of 4 scalar functions, a, b, psi, and e. And because of this coupling, it's useful to employ the following gauge of our potential to move it up. It's just a combination of delta phi and psi. So here the primes are derivatives with respect to tau at the whole time, and they will be this way throughout the rest of the talk. So this is a parameter that we're interested in evolving. And so the next step is to Fourier decompose this thing into positive and negative frequency modes. And note that the Fourier coefficients obey the following wave equation. So this is a wave equation with a time-dependent mass. Z double prime over z is where all the cosmological data is input. And under certain circumstances, we can exactly solve this equation. And in particular, when z double prime over z is close to constant, this is the case solar inflation or the exactly soluble case of power law inflation, U behaves in the following way. So U is a Hank function, and it's instructive to look at the behavior of U in various limits. So as we go back in time, so tau during inflation is negative, or runs from negative infinity up to zero. So going back further in time is taking k tau to minus infinity. So we're looking at smaller and smaller light scales, and as the light scale mode is smaller and smaller, it reduces the following plane waveform, as you'd expect that it would in flat space field theory. As k tau goes to zero at wait times, the mode is redshifted and has become larger than the horizon. And as we mentioned, due to causality, this function ceases to evolve, and in fact it does. So this combination happens at a constant.
So what is mu? Mu, what is
mu is the root of the Bessel function.
Yeah, sorry, this is
the black button.
It's fourth plus n squared root squared, something like that.
Right, this is going to be some combination of smaller parameters.
Okay.
So this is just a quick tutorial of what's happening with the mode function. So time is running from left to right here. These are small scales, these are large scales. Well, when it's well within the horizon, the mode is oscillating, and then it grows, crosses outside the horizon, and freezes out.
Excuse me. Oh, I think I
missed
something.
Here,
you're not assuming a slow
report,
or just
the numbers are more slow? Well, no, I'm saying that in the limit that we are slowly rolling, or in the limit that inflation is power law, then we can exactly solve
the same.
I think it's not constant, it's one. It's a constant of the beta squared and the z double prime. So it's the z double prime.
Oh, okay. Sorry. All right, so we want to be able to relate this U variable, this engine variable, to something physical, namely the curvature perturbation. Because after all, that's the spectrum we're trying to measure. So a popular one is the curvature perturbation as measured on co-moving hyperspaces. So these are the spatial slices of observers who are moving with worldlines or orthogonal to the hypersurface. And let's rewrite the Gaussian variable potential just for comparison. So due to the coordinate variance of GR, we have gauge degrees of freedom that are propagating. And in order to fix them, we need to select the choice of gauge. So right off the bat, by suggesting that we take co-moving hypersurfaces, we can remove delta phi, which is the Hamilton fluctuation. And we have a further freedom of requiring that the spatial curvature be isotropic, and so the E drops out. And the nice thing is this allows us to relate U to R in the following way. So then you go ahead and define your power spectrum for R. We've seen this before. And using this relation, we can now write the power spectrum in terms of the Gaussian variant variable U that we're solving. Okay, so this is the power spectrum for the scalar perturbations. So let me just spend a slide talking about the tensor perturbations. These are also generically generated during inflation. These are much simpler to deal with. The perturbation is described by just a single function, h by j. H by j is purely spatial. The dynamics follow from the linearized Einstein equations, and they're like this. So after fixing some gauge degrees of freedom, we can decompose h by j into two scalar modes, polarization modes. And then we want to rescale them using the following prescription. And when we do that, we see that the Fermi modes of V obey the following wave equation, which looks very reminiscent of the scalar equation of motion. So each individual polarization mode of the tensor perturbation evolves as a decoupled, sorry, not decoupled, a free scalar field in the Fermi background. And so we can go ahead and analogously define the power spectrum of the gravity waves in the following way. So this final expression here takes into account both polarization modes. Okay, so let's put all this together. We obtain the background evolution by solving the system of flow equations. And in this analysis, we truncated a sixth order. You could go higher or lower, it's up to you. For randomly drawn initial conditions, once we have a background, we want to be able to obtain the power spectrum. So we need to solve these two equations. These are the two mode equations I wrote down previously, but here they're written in terms of m. F is this collection of solar parameters. Now we need to be careful about initializing the mode function. So how do we choose initial conditions for U and V? Well, in theory, as we go in smaller and smaller length scales, as I mentioned, these modes should reduce the plane wave forms. In particular, they should reach what's called the Montague's vacuum, which has a very important normalization out front here, root 1 over 2k. But in practice, we can't go back to minus infinity. We have to impose this initial condition at finite time. So clearly, the larger you take the absolute value of k tau, the better the approximation is, the closer you are to the true one of k is funded. But if you take tau, or take k tau very large, you'll see that the efficiency of the numerical code is just terrible. So there's a trade-off. If you take k tau too small, then you'll begin to see modulations in the spectrum, get the transbanking effects. So the finite size of the cutoff becomes important. So you need to find a sweet spot. K tau equals minus 100 is pretty good. Other people have used k tau as minus 50, so this is a little bit more accurate than that. So we initialize each node like this, and then we just solve the system for multiple k values and just build the power spectrum discrete.
Have a good question?
Yeah.
Actually, it's on the previous slide, but it doesn't matter. But whenever you draw the random, maybe it's on the previous slide, but anyway, but whenever you draw randomly over, like just a flat distribution on those parameters?
Right. Typically, you'll draw them from smaller ranges, because you do want to sort of the higher order parameters, some smaller or lower order. But it's not too sensitive to the overall scheme that you use.
Maybe a suggestion. Maybe wrong. To bring from minus infinity to some finite, but still, couldn't use an approximation, an analytic approximation.
Well, you can assume that. I'm not exactly sure how you mean.
Yeah, you can do a numerical solution. Yeah. You have to start a numerical solution somewhere.
Yeah, but instead of
you could take that
as a precise vacuum value, use like a WPB, maybe is it the right range for the WPB?
Well, that is WPB, but you could include the correction.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you actually stick the
hand. Yeah, these are the same. So going on.
We didn't investigate that. We played around with actually matching the solution onto the power law equation solution, so the actual Hankel function, and there's really no difference. There's no point there. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a really good approximation, surprisingly. Yeah, thank you. It's a good question. All right, so as I mentioned, we have all these crazy flow spectra that we generate, and we want to figure out if they give good fit to the data. So what exactly do we mean by that? Well, let's pick some base, simple power law spectrum with which we can pick a file. So this is just some fiducial spectrum I've chosen with the following parameterization. So in order to fully specify the cosmology, you need more than just the primordial power spectrum. You need to specify a couple other numbers. So the first two are just the densities of the baryons and the CDN. Tau is the optical depth randomization, and H is the present day Hummel parameter. And so the likelihood of this entire model will denote by L naught. Okay? So the idea is to replace this fiducial power law spectrum with the more generalized spectrum we've just made. And then we want to calculate the new likelihood of this trial model. Yeah.
So when the WMAP guys do it, they let all those other parameters flow upfloat as well, right?
Yes, they
do. Does it make a huge difference for you guys? If you let everything else flow, would it change things a lot?
If we actually tried to do a Bayesian analysis here, we get nowhere.
Okay.
As you'll see, the error bar is going to get really big, as you might expect. So this is kind of conservative. By fixing these other things, we're looking at the best case scenario. So it could be much worse than this if there's discrepancies with the other parameters.
Sorry, but what else do you fix?
So we fix all the background, all the cosmological parameters, like we fix these four. And then we replace these with these general aspects that we've made using the flow approach.
But is that a reasonable thing to do? Because that's just as uncertain as those other parameters. Right?
Why isn't it reasonable?
I mean, I'm saying that all these parameters are just as uncertain as those parameters. I mean, they are supposed to be constrained by the same data, mm-hmm. So I can fix that.
That's still an interesting question, because it's just saying, well, let's just leave it at
all. It is just a question of what prior to use. I mean, he's just using these, but I know...
Well, prior is one thing, but fixing parameters is another.
Well, I guess the point is, from Mark's end, I don't really care about these. I care about these.
So you're really more like marginalizing over those. That's what
I suppose. Well, it's not very good.
Yeah, very much. You just leave them be.
So,
it's still a worthwhile question to ask. Like, even if you need these fixed constants, how much freedom do you have? Right.
If the answer is not much, then perhaps it would be an interesting question to ask.
Right.
But as you'll see,
if you didn't get a good fit, then you might say, well, it's because I
right. Exactly.
If you do get a good fit.
So as I said, this is kind of the best case scenario we're doing here. And we'll see that it's
like the errors that you get and your parameters aren't realistic because they don't include.
I'm not trying to actually estimate any parameters. I'm just trying to
on your power spectrum. So that right. Not realistic because that doesn't include the errors in these parameters.
So the errors that I would try to bound my power spectrum with could be larger if I were to vary these as well. That's correct. Okay, so once I've calculated the likelihood of these new flow models, I want to be able to compare. But the flow models, the power spectrum, are functions of six parameters, or flow parameters out to the order that I truncate. Whereas the base power spectrum is simple, it just has two free parameters. And so I can't just go ahead and compare these likelihoods and keep them if they're equal. So I need to somehow take into account the fact that these are more complicated. So I can do that by recognizing that the log likelihood behaves as an effective chi-square. And then I just simply compute the p-value of that chi-square. So here p is the chi-square of PDF, the new degrees of freedom. So I'm taking the degrees of freedom into account when I calculate this number. So the larger the chi-square, the smaller the p-value. The larger the chi-square, which just means that that particular model most likely did not give rise to the data that you're collecting. The overall interpretation of p is not too important. After all, I'm just interested in looking at a difference. I just want to compare two models. And so what I'm going to do is if the p-value for a particular flow model lies within 1% of the Fuchsia model, I'm going to conclude that these things are effectively indistinguishable statistically. So that's what I do. I generate a vast number of models, I calculate the law of likelihood, I calculate this integral, and then I collect those that satisfy this criteria. So let me show you the results of this. This is the Fiducial model, it has some boring parallel spectra here, K, we've been running along the x-axis. And so these are the spectra that we found using the flow approach. So right off the bat, we see that there's a large variation in the spectral shape on these large angular scales. So the current day horizon is around here. So we're seeing variation on superhorizon scales, you might expect, but we're also seeing a fair amount on subhorizon as well. On the plus side, we're seeing that the spectrum across about a decade of K around here is quite well constrained. So that's not. Now you'll notice the color coding. The red spectra are interesting because they are accompanied by large tensor signals. So R on the order of 0.1. This is pretty much expected. If we're going to suppress the scalar power on the large scales, then we need to enhance the tensor power in order to maintain the correct overall amplitude, right? So while these spectra look very disparate, if you look at the actual CL as a result, it's not as striking. So the dashed line is the Fiducial model, and the red line is the CLs that result from what these spectra.
So these are indistinguishable, is that the...
That's correct, that's our conclusion. Now, as I mentioned before, both the tensors and the scalars contribute to the CLs, the temperature, and currently we can't tell them apart. We just see their sum total when we measure the CLs. When we get more information about polarization, particularly beam mode polarization, we'll find, we'll luckily, I think, be able to break this degeneracy pretty well. So you might wonder where all this falls into actual Bayesian analyses that we've done. So this is a plot of R versus N. These are 1 and 2 sigma error contours for WMAP third year and Sloan, where running has been included in the fit. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop a couple of the points associated with the crazy spectrum we saw within this plot on here. And this is where they would lie. So we need to be careful in interpreting what the spectral index for these models means. After all, they're not power law. That's the whole point. So here, NS is just really the first logarithmic derivative of P with respect to K. So it's kind of a local spectral index. This value is not too important. What's interesting is the large values are not performing. So all of these points lie well outside the 1 sigma bound, and one of them is even outside the 2 sigma. And keep in mind, we conclude that these fit the data as well. So exactly what we expect happens does happen. These error bars are getting huge. So we really can't fool ourselves into thinking that this is how logarithm is constrained when I can go ahead and find a model that's all the way out here and seems to do the job just as well.
So your models are far from slow going?
Yes, you'll see. Yes.
So you would expect probably large non-Gaussianity or significant non-Gaussianity?
One probably would.
Could you distinguish them with that?
You probably could, but I think what we're going to find is that we'll distinguish them just from looking at R. Right, but just by just putting a bound on R or a measure of R in the future, we'll be able to tell the difference here. But you're right, non-Gaussianity would also probably be large and very interesting for these models.
I say from beam mode polarization.
Right, I think that's...
I think non-Gaussianity is a more accessible observable than V modes. Unless it's
We don't need to observe, we just need to put another.
It would be larger than one?
No, because, I mean, for a star, it's much smaller than one. So, but, so these are, like, if epsilon is a border one, I'm guessing FNL would be a border one.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still.
Oh, epsilon is always less than one.
Yeah, I think FNL is a border epsilon, right?
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Okay. But V-modes, like, R 0.1 V-modes are going to be measured in 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, I mean, if we can measure R down to 0.01, you know, and we don't see anything, well, then these models are out. And if we do, then our best fit confusion model is out. So, either, another way, we'll learn a lot more once we can get some more information. So, to answer your, to continue your point, what kinds of inflation models generate these crazy spectra? So this is just a tangle of reconstructed potentials from the flow approach. The black ones are what you'd expect from a solar model. They all kind of have this very delicate sloping behavior up here. This is really vulnerable, it's just the horizon. Now the red ones give us these spectra with suppressed power on large scales. They all have this common feature, and there's a sharp drop off, and then they level. And so you kind of hypothesize that the field is going down here. It's probably moving quite quickly by the time it reaches vulnerable versus a field that's just starting out on a very smooth potential. And we can, in fact, verify this. Here is, I've just chosen one of those potentials, and I've drawn it here. Here's our fiducial potential, just some more flat thing. The x-axis is number of V-folds, so this is time running from earlier to later. And if we plot what the kinetic energy is doing, it looks like this. So, in fact, the field is initially rolling very quickly. And in fact, it's rolling so fast that the friction term is dominating the evolution. And so the field is decelerating as it rolls down the potential because it's moving so quickly. So KD is monotonically decreasing across this time interval. However, it's still rather large by the time the durable scales at the horizon. That's what the bar is. And so that's what we're seeing in suppressed power in this case. So it's kind of striking when you look at these two potentials and we're sitting here, we really can't fall apart today. All right, so just to recap what we did, the flow formal is in this unique way to survey a wide range of potentials in a parameterization-dependent manner. So we've just identified this class of fast-rolling models that seem to agree with data as well as more conventional solar models. And we see the largest spectral variation occurs at the low levels, in the CMB where the cosmic variance is a dominant source of error. But as mentioned, on the plus side, in the near future, we should be able to improve the situation considerably. So I want to change gears here and spend the rest of the time talking about another way that we might be able to modify the form of the spectrum, obtain a power spectrum that's not a power law. And it has nothing to do with modifying the inflationary dynamics per se, but instead we're going to reconsider the initial conditions for inflation. And so the question is, can we see free inflationary physics in the sky? Now clearly this is an important question beyond what we're trying to do. But there's a significant amount of overlap. So the nature of the universe prior to inflation is unknown. Inflation could have extended eternally into the past, or it could be finite. Even if it's finite, when we calculate the power spectrum, we typically assume that there's a lot more inflation than is necessary to solve the positive lattice problems. But in this study, we're going to suppose instead that inflation lasts just long enough, just n equals 6, let's say. And the question is, can we see signs of the physics that was occurring in the universe prior to inflation in such a circumstance? So you might ask why we see anything at all. And here's a simple argument. This red line that is a water pole. Scales corresponding to the water pole are already on horizon sizes at 60. So this is some form of fluctuation that's just beginning to exit the horizon as inflation begins. Now, conventionally, if we want to normalize this thing, we need to trace it back in time until it was in the short wave length limit, initialize it, and then we can trust our calculation. So we want to do something like this. However, if we only have 60 volts of inflation, we can't go back any further. Right? And the details of pre-inflationary phase are necessary to figure out what's happening with the smoke. So this is kind of the motivation. So in this paper, we looked at a case where we have a radiation-dominated phase prior to inflation. So we have a scalar field and radiation, but the radiation is dominating the evolution. In such a case, A just goes as tau. So tau now is positive and running from zero to larger values in contrast to what it was doing during inflation. You might wonder how modes evolve in such a background. So this variable y is just the ratio of the horizon size to the proper running length of the mode. And the time derivative of this thing is greater than zero. So what this means is that those are evolving from large scales to small scales during radiation dominated expansion versus the opposite, which is what happens during inflation. So not only does this move that's at the horizon at equals 60, not only is it already large, but as we go back in time during radiation dominated expansion, this thing is larger. So it was never in the UV limit. So how do we handle such a thing? So we need to expect that we have quantum fluctuations existing on all scales at all times. And the subsequent evolution of the fluctuations through the RD phase will lead to modified energy conditions by the time inflation starts.
Sorry, host scales are shrinking, right? If you go back in the past, so they will arrive at whatever small.
All scales are shrinking, that's right. Well, all scales are shrinking, but
but
the mode is growing relative. I'm sorry.
Relative to the mode
is shrinking relative to the past.
But these scales go back in the past arbitrarily. Small and Planck and etc.
But they'll never attain the bunch state's limit though, because they'll always be large in the process.
What do you mean by the bunch state? It's not a considered universe in that
way.
It means the
negative. I mean just the ultraviolet whatever that may be. Okay, so
usually, I mean WKB is not a good approximation, so you can't achieve the vacuum by the amount.
So you can show that the thermal fluctuations that should be existing in the radiation fluid and the inflaton fluctuations effectively decouple during this time if you assume that that swan has lost a lot of quantum. So you assume that the scalar field is a very flat potential. We're also assuming this thing is decoupled, and this is kind of a simplistic point model. And in this circumstance, the mode, the quantum modes of the inflaton evolve according to a very simple wave equation with the following solution, so this linear combination of the positive and negative producing modes. And so we verify that the modes never evolve out of the vacuum.
That's right, just after inflation?
This is during radiation domination still.
Before.
Yeah, this is the pre-inflationary phase. We still have these fluctuations in the scalar field, but they're just doing this. They're not evolving, they're sitting in slight waves. So the next question is, so how do we achieve vacuum? We don't know anything about the nature of the large scale fluctuations. Because we don't have a WKB approximation. But we expect that as we go to smaller scales, they should reduce to the Bunch-Davis form, or a form that looks very much like this. We can achieve this by simply taking C1 equals to the canonical normalization and C2 equals to 0. There's clearly other choices, and you can argue about which one you think is most natural. But this one asymptotes to the terminating vacuum at very small scales, and so we'll take it as our vacuum choice. When that happens, all of our modes look like this on all scales at all times. And so then, if we want to set the initial conditions for inflation, we set them at constant time right when inflation begins. So we just have these modes sitting on all scales doing this.
And these are future boundary conditions. You're saying once the mode comes back inside the horizon, it will be well inside the horizon.
It never comes back. I mean, it comes back to you. To the horizon today, so it's always so these are super horizon modes, right? And you assume they have this kind of vacuum.
These are every mode. That's
every mode is
saying
inside and
outside. If radiation dominated throughout, then far in the future, all modes will be well within the horizon.
Well, I'm really saying that when inflation begins, we have fluctuations existing at all scales, both well within the horizon and outside the horizon. And they all obey this condition.
Why?
Well, because this is a solution to the mode equation.
Yeah, but that choice is for C1 and C2.
I've chosen that.
So if there's only a solution at sub-horizon, it's canonical. Mm-hmm. So I just assume that's true for super-horizon scales.
You probably also, you don't probably need this, right? Because you're sort of just setting up this, you're sort of, aren't you sort of just setting up like the sub-horizon physics that's going to then be taking
well,
the place it's going to take outside the horizon?
Well, it's the opposite of that, because all my interest in physics is occurring, water holes are already large. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why you can't take this at large scales.
But this solution's only about K to now much larger than 4 and
what?
I think radiation dominated, that's the solution to this work all the time.
Ah.
Yeah, that's the
one.
That's the target.
Right.
But that's very funny. Well,
it's radiation dominated, right?
And this negotiation is smart. It's coming from back here.
Just because it's conforming in that
way.
Well, if that's the case, I'm sorry.
It's like a Penrose.
If it was outside conforming in that would be the dynamic for
a being. Just some certain difference. We're just assuming that it's some fluctuation that just pops from existence. It's some, you know, highly off-shell mode. We certainly love that.
There's actually no horizon for radiation.
That's
what Chester was. Yeah.
Oh, is that?
But there is,
well,
but why is, are you sure about
that? There's some horizon. No, because it's conforming very much to close pieces. So
there's
no. Depends what you mean by
horizon.
There's no sound.
Because it's got like sound. But it didn't.
There's nothing like H in this situation in the radiation dome. It doesn't act as a horizon, like it does in the sun.
Right.
But there are some separations that are too great to have been encountered.
Yeah, but we don't care about
the real horizon.
Right.
We mean the word horizon.
Yeah, that's right. But what we don't mean the real horizon. We mean
right.
We mean does the WKB approximation break down? There's no scale. Normally that scale is set by the k squared is z double prime of the sun, but if that's zero, then it never breaks down.
Okay, so that's a different question. What about the real horizon? Are these within the real horizon?
The actual causal horizon?
Yeah.
No, there are fluctuations in all the scales, including those that are larger than the causal horizon. So, I don't know, the physical interpretation of that is a tricky one. I can't think of a reason why you could forbid the quantum mechanics to be operated on the scales, super broad. At least in the vacuum. So, as long as this thing is decoupled.
Why would it select any particular standard expectation?
So, well, that's still a weird to come in and kind of treat things by hand. So, we just kind of consider this an ansatz for a particular choice of vacuum. It is a choice of vacuum after all.
I understood that perturbation grow up to 10 to the minus 5. Because there is inflation, right? So the amplitude really of the perturbation on some scale cannot grow given radiation emission. So
it's not growing.
It's not growing.
No, that's the whole idea.
So okay, so if you take the quadrupole amplitude, the quadrupole wavelength, you enter inflation that it's already at the size of the horizon. Then it exits immediately out to the size of the minus 5. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's good. That's the whole point of looking at this. So once we initialize the modes using this, we evolve them according to the standard inflationary background. So either problem or Z is appropriate to whatever your model is. Okay, so what happens? As I was mentioning, the small scale fluctuations should behave a lot like they do in ordinary inflation, because this approaches the inflationary vacuum in the ultraviolet. But these large-scale modes that obey this form are very different from those that would have attained those scales through inflation. And so we will see a difference. In fact, this is what it looks like. The dotted line is a conventionally found power spectrum for some inflation model. I think this is power law that shows. And the red spectrum is what happens when we impose this radiation-dominated phase.
So you're saying because you're at the beginning of inflation, you're effectively putting modes in their bungalows vacuum all the way to the horizon.
Exactly.
They're not as amplified as
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're very low momentum modes. So again, the horizon's not here, and this amounts to effectively doing a cutoff in the power spectrum on scales horizon size. So how do you attain 10 to minus 5? Well, the interesting thing is the change in likelihood between these two models given currency median is 1/1. So even though we see this drastic change, the cosmic variance is so large on these scales that we simply can't tell this apart. If you further consider the fact that we've added a free parameter to this model, namely how many equals of inflation we have, we really can't tell this apart.
Mostly if you put federally involved, it'll just go away.
Yeah,
push this thing around.
Exactly. So this is what happens across different durations of inflation. So I'm assuming the quadrupole leaves the horizon at n equals 60. Mm-hmm. If we look at n equals 61, so this is the case of one e-fold of inflation before the quadrupole leaves the horizon, we see that we're washing the effect out. And if you go larger than 61, it's gone. So the effect is strong at low L's, and we see that these are just completely overlapping on smaller scales. But as I said, the error is just so large here that we can't make any details there. But interestingly, if you look at the cross correlation, so this is the temperature and the E-mode polarization, we see the effect is larger for some reason that we're not too sure about, which kind of gives us the hope that improved measurements of the E-mode polarization might be able to resolve this effect relative to the standard scenario. Okay, so I'd like to conclude. To answer the question I posed, I think it kind of depends on what scale you're talking about. Clearly, the spectrum is very poorly constrained on large scales. We really don't know what the nature of things are. But it is pretty well constrained on the intermediate length scales. So we've obtained varied forms of power spectrum by considering non-trivial potentials, as well as by modifying the conditions. And while currently degenerate, I think the future is hopeful that polarization measurements might save the day. Thank you.
All right, we have time for questions. Can I have one to start?
Exactly.
whatever you're talking about, the evidence or the comparing your effect of the flow thing. You said that by integrating the probability function starting at chi-square of the Earth, that you were somehow taking into account the fact that you had more degrees of freedom. But I mean, a more standard way to do that is some kind of Bayesian evidence or something like that. So just naively looking at it, didn't look like the likelihood was changing much whenever you went to these multiple parameters. Is that correct?
In which case, the flow case?
Yeah.
The likelihood only changes by a couple for that range
right.
of value.
So if you look at that from purely Occam's razor perspective, then you probably can just throw those rule those models out on an Occam's razor basis.
Well, I mean, you'd actually have to calculate the evidence. I think the key here is when you calculate the evidence, if you had it, we didn't have it. So partly we made it this way because it was feasible. If you were to calculate the evidence, you probably wouldn't even notice these extra parameters because the data is not constraining them.
Yeah, but there's a cost whenever you do this by having extra dimensions.
Yeah, but only if it's impacting the data. I think there's
if it doesn't impact the data, it very much weights against it. That's the point of using an evidence thing. It's something like delta chi squared over the degrees of freedom. So if you get more degrees of freedom, then you get a worse evidence.
Okay.
So anyway, it's fine. I completely understand what you're doing. I just was wondering if you had done that. But I guess if you just use
fun, you need to do some likelihood analysis. You need the full posterior, and that would take.
No,
my understanding, right? Or no?
I mean, you can do. I mean, you can do it within your set. I mean, there's no reason.
Well,
as long as you.
I actually proposed one myself. But there's many ones, but the very simple one, you just subtract out the number of degrees of freedom from the log likelihood. I don't think it's that well motivated, but something.
Well,
but that's an example. It's a very easy direction to make. You don't need to do a lot of.
I considered using the information criteria that you're suggesting, but these are approximations to the evidence calculation. But I was in the understanding that. The number of parameters you subtract off should be all measured parameters.
What's the number of parameters you included in your problem?
I don't think this is the question that he's trying to answer. He's not answering the question, is there evidence for a second, six derivative of H of Y? I think, I'm sure the answer is no, there is no evidence.
Quite honestly,
No, this is
not well constrained of it. If you say you have a hierarchy of things, how well constrained?
Yeah, how well? I think
that's more like a
sorry.
Okay, I don't see why it's going. So, I mean, if you want to say that this is a competing model.
No, I'm not trying to really. Well,
I thought that's what you're supposed to say.
I think.
Or otherwise, why is it interesting?
Well, I would say based on the calculation with the chi-square, it is a competing model.
Yeah, so then these issues come in.
Right, well, if you want to say it's a competing model, then you have to motivate that. I mean, on an Occam's razor basis, you have to have some kind of evidence that you're improving the fit by adding more parameters. Because you're muddying the waters. And so if you can get the same predictions out of some kind of model, then Occam's razor says that you should.
Right, no, I agree. I agree with that.
Anyway, maybe I should let somebody else ask your question. Sorry.
So you were given, was that a general result that you always get a large running for this model, or could you like change the initial distribution?
You get a whole bunch of different kinds of structure. Those are the ones that are deviating the strongest. If I went to, for instance, higher order in the flow space, so larger than 6th order, like 12th order, I might find even crazier stuff. The idea was 6th order is high enough to really tease in the product spectra, and since we're really just trying to establish, you know, the best case scenario here.
But for all of them, you get a large prime, is that right? Or you could get a small, because the question was that if the future experiment shows that you have a small running, that these models are ruled out. But if you tell me even you can obtain a model with a small running, then I assume that maybe you're doing something here.
No, I obtain models with no running. When you run the flow code, you generate millions of models. And many of the spectrum would lie right along the fiducial power law. So you find a lot of very uninteresting solar models. But you do find a couple that are truly interesting, since they do deviate significantly from that form. One of the questions that I find interesting is whether or not going to higher order will allow you to find an inflation model with strong running, but with not large sensors. These things tend to go hand in hand at lower order, right? If you're going to have strong running, you're probably going to have big tensors. But whether or not that you can kind of break that relationship as you go to higher order is not something that's clear. The order of the method does, strongly impact the types of structure that we
follow. I have another question. Sorry, use my privilege. Whenever you find these rare far from solar models, is it stable around that? Like, can you take a small perturbation around those parameters to find a working model that's far from solar rolling? And like, you find them as points. I'm sure they're points for you, but can you take epsilon around that and they all work or not?
That's a really good question. So it depends on the order of the flow analysis. I think at lower orders, the flow equations are quite stable to small perturbations in initial conditions. But as you go to higher orders, we're not really sure what it looks like. The answer is no. If you kind of move like 5 lambda a little bit, you can, by the time you evolve to late times, you can end up with a very different trajectory. So you could go from a hybrid model to the ordinary model again with our small function one, for instance. So it does seem like that's the case, perhaps to small perturbations.
So that means
So it makes switching the parameter space in some sort of like a Monte Carlo Markov chain very difficult, perhaps, because you might not get anywhere.
Have you thought about another? It seems like it'd be nice to have a full hierarchy that you would always find less important effects for the higher order you go. Can you see from your numerical solutions why is it the high terms are causing such sort of chaos?
It's hard because the dimensionality of space is so thick.
Sure, no, I understand. I was just curious if you had like some effect.
So there's a really good paper by Stabia, somebody else, I can't remember, where they kind of study the dynamics of the flow space to third order. And they can fully delineate the regions of stability and instability and attractor regions and everything. Mm-hmm. So at that order, you can kind of understand what's happening, but it's very difficult to figure out that.
I think I just put in something that you said you kind of didn't measure the system. Did you really say that all these extra parameters don't make any difference? That you can sort of choose them as you like and you get an equally good
one? You can't just choose them as you like, I think.
But they're very, very weak, only very, very weakly constrained.
If you were to actually try to put fits on these things, yeah, I think you'd find that they're very good.
I think you find different combinations that work together, right? I mean, it's not just the regions of the parameter space, or there's like particular combinations.
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know what the relationship between the values of the flow parameters are, actually. So I haven't made like a scatter, like that scatter plot. Actually, we haven't done that for this case. But that's an interesting question.
Is there some like small parameter which guides the expansion? That tells me that if I go to 7th order in the flow expansion, it's as good as the 6th.
I don't know. Where's that question?
So, normally when we do expansions, the validity of the assumes that the net higher order terms are smaller.
Well, you So the flow equation, the solution to the flow equation is essentially a Taylor expansion of H. That's truncated at the order of that the flow equations are truncated. So in that sense, by truncating the flow equations, you do a require all higher order flow terms to zero, and they are for all time. So
I agree it's an exact solution, but I guess I'm asking a slightly different, but it's more to do with stability. That so that solution may be exact, but if I then go to one higher order in the flow expansion, mm-hmm. and you get a different answer, then that's suggesting that solution sort of not a stable point. So it's more, is there some small parameter going with stability of the expansion?
So that would be the coefficient of the 7-order term, so like that's a small number.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying, is there some...
Typically, it's still a divergent series, more or less, because it has to be. I think if you have large higher order terms and you're not going to inflate for long enough, or something else terrible happens to your evolution, typically you'll still see the higher order parameters getting smaller and smaller as you go out. But these are the higher order parameters in the interesting spectrum of that are larger than the higher order parameters would be for a power law spectrum. But we're still seeing this relationship where they're decreasing as you go to higher order. So you don't expect to all of a sudden see some large higher order parameter for no reason.
So it's sort of like several with epsilon isn't much less than one, but still less than one, so as you.
Sure. You still have the hierarchy. But there's a lot of things to be larger.
It still is a derivative expansion of some sort.
It is a Taylor expansion.
Taylor expansion, so whatever you see.
So you see, if delta phi is small, so.
The Taylor expansion in
U4. In H of phi, it's a Taylor expansion of H of phi, isn't it? It's
in the
more lots, huh?
In the interval, in the field.
Yeah, no? It's very intuitive when you have an expansion.
The solution to Taylor expansion is 5.
So it's a few moves, just a little, like in this little row.
Right,
yeah. The expansion is definitely converging in the region of interest or the parameter space, which is.
I mean, stability issues aside, that's an interesting point you raised. But as far as having no basis for an approximation, that's really not the case here. You're really just selecting out a specific subgroup of polynomial potentials to describe H drift, because we're not going to do it at the end of the day. So the flow approach does sample a specific region of the flow model space of H drift.
Sure. But still is the point, like if you go to 8th order in the flow expansion, it's very different from 7th order then.
But that's not dependent on the models. I mean, if you don't have any models, then you don't really know what.
Right, and that's sort of the point, is that this isn't like an expansion around some model. It's just sort of like, you're sort of like just trying to explore the basic possible models. Right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Right, but that's fine. But
and if you restrict yourself to a particular model, then you can tune this expansion such that it always is. Yeah, no, I mean, though I guess I would worry if I found, like, you know, like I'm finding models that don't seem to be convergent or stable, then maybe those are not bad models for other.
I guess if you just didn't like unstable models, I mean,
if you truncated at 6th order and the same set of parameters with a 7th order term was very different, then I would worry.
Well, so I'm not sure if that's the case. I think if you go to one higher order, you're not going to see drastic changes in the solutions. Your question is more like within some order. If I start to perturb variables, what do I see as far as the trajectories are concerned? There's definitely stability there, I think. But just tacking on an additional parameter and then redoing the flow approach, I don't think you're going to see a drastic change in the outcome.
So if I think of this as a Taylor expansion, I have some if you go to order 6, it says some 6-dimensional surface that my models live on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what you're saying is if I try to pop up in the 7th dimension, there's not a whole lot of change. It's kind of stable in that sense. But within that surface, if I just tweak along that surface, there's possible instability there.
But I mean, it's connected, because if you have an extra velocity in the 7th dimension, you know, that'll generally, you know, change the value of the field in the sinks, and so if it's unstable, then
yeah.
It's those I'm not explaining that very well. So I guess the point is, so you have six flow parameters, just to say, and we just leave all of those fixed, and you add the seventh flow parameter. The idea is that you just told me that if I change the sixth flow parameter a little bit, I may have a solution that varies a lot from the previous solution, right? And so if you add that seventh parameter, and it's a small number, but it's enough to sort of like
tweak the sixth. You can absolutely affect the single model, I think, by adding a single model. But when you look at the ensemble of models, mm-hmm. in terms of the different types of models that you get, by adding additional flow parameter, when you generate this swap of points, for instance, you won't see a very large difference in the phase plots.
In which model you generate.
Right. You're still, a particular model might change the output by tapping a different parameter, but like the sum total of the full mm-hmm. collection of models in the bay won't look that different.
You're not really looking for particular models, but more like looking for the kinds of predictions that one could get from models.
Right, that's kind of the point of flow approach, because if you need a large number of models that fit some particular criteria, then you just kind of throw the code at it, and then you let it do its thing, and then you collect those that you do. So.
Any other questions? Yeah, just one, sorry. Have you ever talked about possible relations between this model that starts with just 60 equals and the actual size of the universe? Because now the universe may be not like infinite or much, much bigger than x to the minus 1, but maybe like finite and all the same. I don't know. Maybe your model has a lower bound on the actual size of the universe.
Well, I mean, we made no assumptions about that in this analysis. I know that if you assume, finite size of the universe and the curvature scale is, let's say it's a closed universe, and it's and you just get 60 d-poles, for instance, you might be able to see curvature effects in a very similar way as we've done here. But I don't think the radiation dominated stuff really needs to tie into anything like that.
Then you
assume
the flat spatial
effect. Right. I mean, we do assume a high degree of homogeneity.
It's unsatisfying, isn't it? It's
just one.
If you were just at 60 d-poles, there's not such a good motivation for that. I mean, that makes sense also for
curvature. Sure. Yeah, a fully rigorous analysis would have to address all these issues.
Right. Just as I don't know if it's relevant, but I mean, depending on which problem you're solving, normally you want 65 e-folds of AH rather than a scale factor. So, and normally that's the same because H is very much. But if you have these non sort of old things, would that make any difference?
I don't know.
But
it
turns out
that you cannot vary H that much
on a
scale so
far. Well, that's the sort of
old
assumption,
right? That's right.
It's the range of the energy.
It can't vary that much, but it could feasibly vary by 10. Yeah, that's right. Why we usually have slow roll is not because you need that information.
It's
to get the 60 e-folds.
Yeah.
But if you then ask this more general question of what in the most general space of solutions will give you a reasonable power spectrum, then it's really the 60 volts of AH that you want. So I don't know, probably the effect is small, I'm sure it is.
Well, I have a completely random thought, but what you're really doing is you're saying what kind of crazy potential can give me a scale invariant spectrum over some range of e-folds, let's say 10, over the CMB, because you've sort of got your crazy model to fit the data pretty well, mm-hmm. as much as a slow roll model. So wouldn't an equivalent way of solving this problem be, I want that in your equation motion for u, which was u double prime plus k squared u minus z double prime over z, for that to be scale invariant over 10 e-folds, you want z double prime over z to be approximately 2 over eta squared. So could you try to solve this for them? It's just a second order equation for z.
Yeah,
and then turn around and try to solve for the
16 equals to B2.
Yeah, for 16 equals to B2, and then solve for the most general potential that would generate that.
Less work, yeah.
Why is it non-linear? I mean, because I could have some non-linear arbitrary equation of motion that also becomes scalar.
No, but just in the class of single field.
Yeah, in the class of single field, looking at, I know the perturbation equation, and I know the exact, even though your background is crazy, still in the perturbation equation, it feeds it in some form that's close to 2 over A to the square over Z double prime over Z.
Sure, I mean, that's assuming you round.
So it seems that you can solve this exactly almost. You know.
We just have
numerically,
a
you can solve for the most general potential.
And you can just have a class of, and you can just have a free set of them.
That's right.
You can just even more.
You would have the usual slow roll plus measure zero examples that somehow have. I don't know, it's just a problem.
No, so you know, I think especially after you know now where to look for that. Like, so after having done this, we know what range of K values are really well described by power law. So now we kind of know where to focus in, and that's really a good idea.
There's something wrong with this thing. So when you say it approximates 2 over a square, then you're assuming it's a smooth, right? Or, I mean, because the constraints on the factors of the power spectrum, that's for a smooth power spectrum. So, and he's, the term that he's looking at are the terms that are not smooth. So they are like higher order derivatives.
It would have to be smooth over that path, is the point. Because there's a skimpy pass that has to be smooth, and that's the flat.
You don't really know that. I mean, if you have like a small oscillations on the skimpy, you don't really have any constraints
on that. So, this would be some subset of the model, probably acceptable model, but you're not exhausting.
But I'm saying simply assuming that you have this full power spectrum, that's already ruling out those higher order.
Oh, you're saying these small scale features are washed out from the
Yes.
And do you know if like all those kind of crazy spectra, if you can like if you like resolve them better, do you see small variations like during in the sort of relevant C and D space for
In CLs?
No. In the K range, it's well constrained. Can you like if the crazy spectra are they smooth during that in that area, or can if you like zoom in, can you like?
They're smooth. They're not all flat. I mean, there's some running on the scales as you just alluded to, because we don't know. But they're smooth. I mean, there's really no. Any oscillations you would see, I would be very skeptical that those are actual. That was not numerical.
Right. There wouldn't be oscillations, but you would have basically if you have a polynomial, you would have up to the number of terms, the minimum or maximum. So may not have, but it can have the subcategory of them have like a six degree polynomial has 6 minimum, 3 minimum, 3 maximum. Right. So the more terms you have, the more of these you can have.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. It's going to be a lot of discussion.